From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Revolutionary-era philosopher, pamphleteer Thomas Paine had an idea to give all American children a leg up in life. Baby bonds. Yes, that's money from the government for every child, rich or poor, but of course, it's really intended to help impoverished people. And that was back in the 1790s. More than two centuries later, New Jersey Senator Cory Booker ran for president on the idea. It didn't fly. But then came the pandemic, which exposed the depths of economic inequality in this country. And then there were the mass protests against racial inequality as well. So is it a different enough world now? And time to give baby bonds another look. So let's talk about this hour. On Point, reconsidering baby bonds. And joining us to help us do that is Derek Hamilton. He's executive director of Ohio State University's Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. He's also a professor of economics and public policy at the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. Professor Hamilton, welcome to you.
Thank you. Glad to be on your show.
So first of all, let me ask you, there has been actually a change in the tenor of conversation around reparations, for example. So do you see that change as being sufficient to raise the hopes of people like you who advocate for the idea of baby bonds?
Well, you know, let me also say with clarity that reparations and baby bonds are complements, not substitutes. That in a well-functioning society, I think you would have to redress the injustices that have taken place for a long period of time in our country, beginning with slavery, with a full-throated reparations program where there's an admission of all the harms that have taken place and then some redress to come along with it. That would directly, in a parsimonious way, address the racial wealth gap. But going forward, even after you implement a reparations program, we know that there are capitalist trends for concentrations of both economic and political power at the top, and namely concentration of capital. So if we want to, just like Thomas Paine thought of, as you mentioned, over two centuries ago, if we want to ensure that everyone has the access and ability to accumulate assets, we need to ensure that there is some seed capital at the key point in their life when they are entering their young adulthood, so that they can invest in an asset that offers them economic security and passive appreciation over the course of their life.
Well, if I can just jump in here, point well taken, and about how you see reparations and baby bonds as complementary policy proposals. We're going to come back to that a little later in the show because the political realities still around reparations, even if the tenor of the conversation has changed, are quite complex. They're also complex around baby bonds too. So we'll get to that. But let me, for people who maybe haven't yet been fully versed in the idea, lay it out for us. Put some dollar figures on there. I know that Senator Booker has been talking about this for a while, but. You know, 2020 is the kind of year where January 2020 might as well have been like 5,000 years ago. So lay out some of the numbers. What would a baby bonds proposal actually look like?
Sure. And you know, as you mentioned, 2020 speaks to the question about the political moment. I mean, few of us would have thought that we would have been in a pandemic where we literally hibernated the economy and that we would have this massive Black Lives Matter movement that's not even just national, but global. So the Overton window of when it becomes politically palpable, who can predict it really, given what circumstances take place? And it's a just policy. So regardless of the political moment or not, we should pursue justice. In the framing of Martin Luther King, I'll butcher the quote, but the arc of something bends towards justice. But to answer your question, you know, it's a simple idea. The idea is that even if you have a society where you want people to benefit off of their ingenuity, off of their hard work, without capital, all we do is lock in inequality. The difference between a renter and a homeowner is a down payment. The difference between a worker and an entrepreneur, you know, a worker could have all the best ideas in the world, but if they have no capital, they can't bring it to fruition. So what baby bonds does is provide everybody a birthright to capital. It doesn't guarantee an outcome, but it provides everybody with at least a shot to accumulate wealth over their life course. So the numbers would be, you know, we like the stakeholder framing that was offered by Thomas Paine and also continues to today when we think about programs like Social Security. So everybody would get some endowment at birth. You could imagine that if you're born into the most wealthy family, you would get something more nominal in the range of, say, 500 to 1,000. But if you're born into the most wealth-poor family, a family without assets, you can get upwards to $50,000 or $60,000 in the version that, you know, I put forth. And the average endowment would be about $25,000. So, you know, in the United States...
Can I just jump in here? So, the average number you're saying, that would be by the time the baby becomes an adult. Is that right?
You could think of that average in present value terms by the time that baby becomes an adult. So, you know, if we see the accounts now, 21 or 18 years from now, we know that inflation will lead to a devaluation of what $25,000 would mean today. Yeah. So the accounts would get a nominal interest rate return so that they would be worth at least $25,000 in the future.
Mm-hmm. And the idea is like that little bit of seed money at the birth of a child, but then depending on income, which means I suppose it could fluctuate year after year, the Treasury would seed a little bit more into these Treasury held accounts until the child turns 18 or 21.
That's right. So there've been a couple of versions of baby bonds put forth. I could talk about Senator Booker's plan, which is one where he would seed everyone at birth $1,000. And then over the lifetime of that child, before the child reaches adult, they would get additional resources depending on their family's economic circumstance. So, you know, the most wealthy children would not get any additional seed money, but the ones that have lower incomes would get more over the years. Now, one other nuance is that, you know, at the time when, and Ayanna Pressley also has a House version of this, when Senator Booker and Representative Pressley were thinking about baby bonds, originally it was before a lot of the conversation around wealth tax. I think now a new version, we would recognize that the federal government can come up with mechanisms to identify families' wealth position, and wealth would even be a better identifier of the position of the child.
Right. And I was just going to jump in here and say that because we don't want to use the terms income and wealth interchangeably because they're not the same thing. And in fact, that was one of the questions I was going to ask you, that if we're talking about baby bonds as a political instrument to help close an intergenerational wealth gap in this country, how can we do that if the best measurement we have right now is income, which is not the same thing?
That's right. And that's suggestive that, in my view, our federal government needs to evolve to come up with better metrics to identify household wealth. And I don't think it's going to be that much of a stretch, especially since any account holdings greater than $10,000 generally gets reported to the IRS anyway. And if we look at ways in which we value homes, we're becoming more and more sophisticated at coming up with accurate numbers. And most Americans that have wealth generally store it in the form of a home. So, you know, there's an evolution where if we're thinking about economic security, we need to become more astute with identifying wealth.
Mm. So, Professor, I actually love numbers, even though they always tell me that numbers don't work on the radio, but I love them. So can you put some more numbers about what the gap is that these baby bonds would aim to close? I mean, we're talking about a racial wealth gap. We're talking about a class wealth gap here. Put some numbers on how big that gap is.
Yeah, I mean, there's the notion in our country, not notion, the reality that the top 0.1% of earners control as much of our nation's wealth as the bottom 90%. And that the bottom half of old households, so those making less than 50% of the median income, they control only 1% of our nation's wealth. So what that means is that, you know, we lock in inequality. So the ways in which, and let me make this point a little clearer, most Americans do not engage in active savings as the mechanism to generate wealth. Because, you know, we have income volatility, we have expenses. Most of the wealth that's generated, if you're not a wealthy family, is because you have an instrument that generates wealth over your lifetime, like paying a mortgage as opposed to paying rent, like being in a graduating from college without debt and having an occupation that puts you in a pension program. Right. So these are the ways in which we generally generate wealth. So the idea would be that everyone would have that pathway to generate wealth. And then, you know, more numbers. If there are 4 million babies born per year and we see the average account at $25,000, that would amount to about $100 billion per year. And when we say those big numbers, they seem large and they scare people away. But in terms of what percent of our current spending, federal spending, $100 billion amounts to, it's less than 2% of what we currently spend. So imagine the returns of being able to give every American the pathway towards wealth building for only 2% of our current spending. And then if we add another context and think about what America spends on asset promotion more broadly, and what would that entail? That would entail being able to deduct your interest from owning a home on your federal taxes, being able to pay a lower rate on your taxes for capital gains as opposed to wages. If you calculate that whole amount of asset promotion that we have, and there are many others, that would amount to about $700 billion in federal expenditures.
Yeah, Professor Hamilton, just stand by for a second here, because as you hear, we've got to take a quick break. Derek Hamilton is the Executive Director of Ohio State University's Kirwan Institute of the Study of Race and Ethnicity, and we're talking with him about whether it's time to reconsider the idea of baby bonds in this country. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This hour, we're talking about whether it's time to reconsider the idea of baby bonds. And we're asking that question because in the midst of this global pandemic, inequality in America has been laid bare for all to see. We also have, once again, a focus on racial inequality in this country. And could baby bonds actually be an idea, racial inequality, I want to be sure I say that, but could baby bonds be a way to make significant changes to both of those problems in this country? So Derek Hamilton joins us this hour. He's Executive Director of Ohio State University's Kirwan Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity, and he's also a professor of economics and public policy at the John Glenn College of Public Affairs. Now, Professor Hamilton, I just want to dig a little bit deeper into how race and intergenerational wealth, there's a strong overlap in this country, right? Because according to some of your own findings, you say that by this year, in fact, median white household wealth in this country will be 86 times more than the wealth in the median black household. So that's a number to sort of wrap our heads around for a moment. But then baby bonds, under some of the proposals that we've been talking about this hour, could end up being roughly $29,000 per child by the time an African-American child reaches the age of 18. And the equivalent average white baby bond account would contain something like $15,800, again, according to one of the proposals we've talked about. So that would go quite a ways to close that gap. It wouldn't close it completely, but it would close it not insignificantly, let's just put it that way. I wanted to offer those numbers here to ask you this question. In this country, like it or not, policy proposals that are directed specifically to remedy racial injustice have had a long and hard road politically. The idea that baby bonds seems to be getting a sort of another lift again because fundamentally, a baby bond would be issued to every child born in this country, regardless of race. So given, and yet it would also have this impact, this sort of proportionately larger impact on Black families, for example, in this country. It's my long way of asking you. You said earlier that you think it should be part of a suite of policies that include reparations. But why? Why not just focus on baby bonds if they're more politically palatable?
Because right now we're in the idea space anyway. So I'm an academic and my job is to generate ideas. The practical implementation of ideas, I advise policymakers, but I don't think we should be constrained by the here and now. I mean, you mentioned that our current reality is such that policies targeted to Black people have less political viability. Well, there's a reason that's true. And part of the reason is will be addressed by baby bonds itself. As America becomes more unequal, then the immoral benefits associated with having an identity become more palpable. So in other words, I mean, we saw it plain and simple when Donald Trump ran in 2016. When he was running and talking about building a wall in a context of despair and inequality, he was appealing to the base in all of us. And unfortunately, we do as human beings care about relative status. So what I'm proposing with baby bonds, reparations, Medicare for all, is an economic rights frame that does not make us, any of us, vulnerable to despotic messages that pit us against one another. So I'm talking about a new society where, in addition to political rights, civil rights, we have economic rights that ensures that everybody has the adequate resources so that we truly can have a meritocracy. In other words, I'm appealing to our shared prosperity. And what we've done in the past with economic rights, we've often compromised the position of Black Americans. That needs to stop if we want to have a moral economy.
I mean, there's really good examples of what you just said, like the Social Security Act early on excluded agricultural and domestic workers, so many of whom were disproportionately Black, right? I mean, that's just one example of when you're talking about
spot on
programs. Yeah, right. So let me ask you though, to your point about access to capital being one of the, not the sole, but one of the important levers to realize a true meritocracy. I think some people, when they just initially hear about baby bonds, they think, what, are we just going to hand a pot of money to teenagers when they turn 18 or 21? But that's not necessarily what you're proposing, right?
That's right. I mean, one could think of this as, and by the way, handing people money is not un-American. It is very steeped in our American history. The Homestead Act, unfortunately, we took native lands to do it. But the Homestead Act pretty much handed a... Uh-oh, am I there?
No, you're still with us. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. The Homestead Act, we literally seeded people with land endowments. The GI Bill, we offered grants. So, you know, it's not... What was done with that seed money was that it grew an American asset-based middle class. So, again, what we're talking about is ensuring that everybody has the resources they need so that they really can have a return on their investment.
Well, if you can just hang on here for a second, Professor Hamilton, I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Wendy Jones joins us from Springfield, New Jersey. She's an author, a playwright, and the writer-publisher of Ida Bell Publishing, LLC. She's written a book about her mother. It's called An Extraordinary Life, Josephine E. Jones. Wendy, welcome to On Point.
Hello. Wonderful to be here.
We wanted to invite you on to sort of get a a real life sense as to what an idea like baby bonds, if it were to be enacted, what kind of difference it would make. And we wanted to actually look at the life of your mother, as you write about in your book, as our vehicle for doing that. And I mean, you really describe her as quite an amazing woman. She worked so hard to accumulate wealth for your family. So can you tell us a little bit about her life and what she had to do to even begin to achieve economic security for your family?
Well, she was born in 1920 in South Carolina to a family of sharecroppers and in Cross Hill, not far from Greenville, South Carolina, where she eventually went to high school, but had to keep going, repeating grades, not because she wasn't good at academic work. She loved reading and thought that reading a book was better than eating at times. But every time they moved, the new school system would say, oh, you have to repeat the grade. You have to repeat the grade. Eventually, she graduated from high school. In 1946, she came to New York to work as a cook in private homes and not sleeping in. She had a room at a cousin's house, but she was only there twice. She was sleeping in. She was only there 2 days a week when she was off. And so she's there all the time, right? So at 3 o'clock in the morning, if the children are sick, she's up helping them. I mean, she's the cook, right? But she becomes everything. And she can't stand this job that has no benefits and no hours. 1935, the Social Security, as you mentioned, was given to many Americans, but not to Black Americans. 60% of Black men didn't get it, and 80% of Black women, and 60% of white women didn't get it. So she didn't get Social Security until 1951. So eventually she went to a temp agency and was hired for 2 weeks to take a temporary position at the then Standard Brands. They made, you know, Chase and Sanborn coffee and Royal Gelatin and Planters peanuts. It's now Kraft Foods. But she was to work in the cafeteria for 2 weeks. She ended up staying 31 years, and she became the supervisor of the employees' cafeteria. So she was able to eventually buy a brownstone, but she had problems. And the problems she had were this. She took a course at NYU called How to Buy a Brownstone. And it was based on a book, You Don't Have to Be Rich to Own a Brownstone, by I think Paul and Joy Wilkes. And so they gave them all the ins and outs because it was based on the experience of whites who were going to college in Fort Greene and were interested in the brownstones, and they were crumbling and falling apart in a Black neighborhood. No one wanted them. So they gave her all the ins and outs. She went to Citibank. I went with her and went to get a mortgage. My mother had stellar credit. Her marriage had broken up when I was 6 months old, but she, you know, worked three jobs and, you know, saved the money. So I graduated debt-free from college because she'd saved the money, and I gave my money in the summer from my summer job. So her credit was stellar, but we didn't even get to the application process. The man behind the desk, who was thin and very elegant looking and silver hair, he said, oh, we don't give money in that area, 137 West 122nd Street near the Apollo, between 7th and Lenox. And now redlining was against the law already. That was 1975. So we went, you know, we left, and my mother did what the course had recommended. She went directly to the owner and got a purchase money mortgage, which meant she directly paid the owner instead of dealing with the bank. And that is how she got the brownstone. Wow. Not from Citibank.
The bank wouldn't even issue loans in that neighborhood.
No, she never even went through. No, they wouldn't. It wasn't even as if they went through her credit and decided it wasn't good. They just said, we don't give money in that area, but come back whenever you want to do home improvements. Now, how are you going to improve a home that you couldn't buy?
Yeah. Wow. So there's another thing that you tell about your mother and the way she lived her life that actually Professor Hamilton's research points to as well. And that is because of the pervasiveness of the lack of capital, if I can just use sort of economics terms here, many people in the Black community find themselves supporting each other, using what little money they have in order to help family members get by. Yeah. And that may be one of the things that puts the brakes on intergenerational wealth accumulation. Did that happen with your mom?
Oh, absolutely. My mother was one of nine children. There were nine of them all together, but she was in the middle, but she was like sort of like the person who was the achiever. And so people would come up and stay with us. I didn't realize this at the time. They would, you know, get on their feet and that sort of thing, but they would never at any point share the housework or, you know, pay part of a bill or pay any rent or anything. And then when they launched themselves and were out of the house and had their own places, they didn't try to compensate in any way. She lent money to siblings who never paid it back, and she couldn't afford for them not to pay it back. And even as a 9-year-old, I said, "Ma, don't give her the money. She won't give it back." You know. Eventually, she stopped, but it was painful because she felt that she should help them. But they, when they did have money, they weren't turning around and giving it, you know, giving anything back to her. So this happens all the time, and it's usually one person who's the giver, and the other people, you know, are, you know, sometimes it's that they can't return the money and sometimes it's that they won't.
Mm-hmm. You know, so many of our family stories are tied into these homes, right? And so I want to know hear a little bit more about what happened to that Harlem brownstone that you grew up in.
Well, I didn't grow up in it. I graduated from college the year that my mother said she wanted a brownstone, and she had taken the course. So she gave me information. Yeah. And she was the brains and I was the feet, and I found the house. And then I went off to teach in Japan for 3 years. I went for 2 years and stayed for three. And so she was on her own after I left. And as she was trying to get the house, she had a lawyer she was using who was the person who had helped with a rental problem we were having when we lived in an apartment. And so he decided that he and his partner should have the house and not my mother, because she was just a Black woman. What did she need a house for? So he was slowing down the process. So the woman had taken back the offer. And it was only because I had a note in the book where I was keeping all my research information that she even found the number to call the owner to work with her. Because you see, I had done the research by looking in all the papers. Now, this was 1975. White people were scared to death of Harlem, and Black middle-class people were getting out because they wanted to find public schools where they could send their children that had better education and get away from the drugs. So if you were selling a brownstone in Harlem in 1975, you put it in the Amsterdam News. This ad I found in the New York Times, and not on Sunday when all the real estate ads were there, but on a Wednesday. So the daughter, who was in her 50s, had lived there since she was five. So she didn't really want to sell the house. She was selling it for her mother, who was in her 90s. The mother was the owner. But the daughter had lived rent-free for all these years and had taken care of it. And she had her own daughter. So she didn't really want to sell the house, right? So I found it just because I looked at every single newspaper, right? So then when we did get the house, we kept it, and my mother did very well with it and was involved with the community and did spring cleanups was the head of the block association and the civilian patrol. They didn't have guns. They would just walk around. It was like community policing, and they would tell the police if there was a problem. So she did all of that. But then she started failing. And I was living in New Jersey with my life partner and our son. And there are no siblings. It's just me. So she was having blackouts and falling down. It was a 12-room, five-story brownstone. It was dangerous. So I had to, you know, we had to sell. She didn't want to. It was a lot of storm and drang about that, but there wasn't enough money. She had money to fix the house, but then she wouldn't have money because of the electrical and the plumbing. It was 1887 the house was built, and it hadn't had an upgrade since the 40s or something. So we knew it needed this, but every time we tried to get people to come to fix it, they found out it was in Harlem because from the address, they thought it was near Columbia. When they found out it was in Harlem, they would cancel and they wouldn't even show up.
Huh.
All right.
Wow.
So you couldn't even, you know, stuff you couldn't even get done. You couldn't get fixed. So things hadn't been done, and it just wasn't viable. And as much as I hated it, because the house was a warm, loving house, you know, some formal houses are kind of stuffy. Mm. This wasn't it. This house embraced you. And so what happened was I had to sell, and I had become my mother's legal guardian. And I knew that the appraisal price, I could get a lot more if I put it on the open market. But I knew that most Black people wouldn't be able to afford that. And I was under I had a surrogate over me. The court was like overseeing it. And I said, look, I know what my mother would want. And she would want, the people next door wanted it, but they could only pay the appraisal price. And so I never put it on the market. They were Black. It was a twin brownstone. Yeah. So that these brownstones were in the middle of the block. And
right. Well, Wendy, if you could just stand by for a second. Yeah. So if you can stand by for a second, I'm sorry I had to jump in on you there. But there's one more question I want to ask you. But we got to take a quick break. So can you hang with us to the other side of the break?
Sure. Absolutely.
Okay, great. So we are talking about whether it's time to reconsider the idea of baby bonds. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about schools again because there is a lot to discuss in how to reopen American schools. But this time, we're going to actually look abroad to several countries around the world and ask what have they done successfully to reopen their schools or unsuccessfully, and what ideas can we import back here into the United States? So if you're abroad or if you know a family that's abroad, what have you seen? What have you heard about what's working and what's not to get kids back in their classrooms? Call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. This hour, we are talking about whether it's time to reconsider the idea of baby bonds. Professor Derek Hamilton joins us, and Wendy Jones is also with us. And Wendy, the one last quick question I wanted to ask you was, you've told us the remarkable story about your mother. But I wonder, so just plainly, if, for example, baby bonds existed when you were born, what difference would that have made in both your life and your mother's life by the time you would have been able to take control of those bonds? What difference would it have made?
Well, my mother probably wouldn't have had to work three jobs so that I could go to private school and later to Yale and Columbia. And also, I did become a writer, but I had to take a detour and do a lot of other things first. You don't have the option to do something that isn't at least bringing in some income, because you don't have that. You don't have that cushion. The idea of being a writer, something that's not usually well paid, is not something that you can just do without having some kind of cushion. So that's the difference it would have made. And it would have been wonderful for my mother to be able to do something on her own. She had ideas about, starting a business in the brownstone with the people in the neighborhood, giving them nutritious food. She's particularly concerned, this, you'll find this funny, with the police, because she said they were overweight, and that's because they were eating bad food, and she wanted them to be able to have decent food, and the other people in the community. So there's a lot she could have done for the community because she wouldn't have had to work those three jobs and could have concentrated more on what she wanted to do with her own talents.
Yeah. Well, Wendy Jones, author and playwright and writer-publisher of Ida Bell Publishing and author of An Extraordinary Life, Josephine E. Jones. Thank you so much for joining us today, Wendy.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed it.
Okay, so let's turn now, Professor Hamilton, hang on here for just a second, because I want to turn now to someone with a different view about baby bonds. Orrin Cass joins us from Lenox, Massachusetts. He's executive director of the conservative think tank American Compass and author of The Once and Future Worker, A Vision for the Renewal of Work in America. Orrin Cass, welcome to the program.
Oh, hi, thanks for having me.
So let me ask you, you just heard Wendy tell the story of her family there and the positive impact that baby bonds would have had on her mother and even, you know, her life. What's your concerns about the idea or your argument against it?
Well, I was incredibly impressed by Wendy's story. It's not clear to me how it's an endorsement of baby bonds. She told the story of a mother who obviously worked very hard and successfully built a good life, saved wealth, and sent her own daughter debt-free to Yale. I think my understanding of the story is they then sold the brownstone for about $1.4 million. And so I think that's a wonderful story at the
appraised price, not the market price, because she wanted to be able to sell it to an African American family,
which was certainly her choice in that instance. But the idea that we would give somebody $50,000 at the age of 18 doesn't seem to me to be especially relevant to her story. And I guess my concern is twofold. You know, one is something Wendy said, which is that, you know, one of the problems with not having a baby bond, she said, is you don't have the option to do something that isn't bringing in at least some income. And I think that's really important. I think it's really important that young people, when they're starting out in their adult lives, don't have the option to do something that isn't bringing in at least some income. I think it's very important that we be connecting people to work and establishing the expectation that they start to build their own lives and their own savings. And I think it's really important to recognize that is the norm in this country. We certainly have some very high income households that start out even as young people with more wealth. Although by and large, if you ask people as parents, do you think you should give your child a $50,000 blank check when they turn 18? They will say, no, that doesn't sound like a good idea at all. But more importantly, the median wealth for a young household, people 18 all the way up to the age of 34, is only $11,000. So it's not the case that most Americans or even a significant share do start out with this big chunk of money. That's not the model, and particularly starting out just a subset with it, I don't think is the approach we should take. I think we should be pursuing policies. I'm open to spending more money, but I think we should be spending more money on building up an education system that has non-college pathways, on supporting people in connecting to that first job, supporting employers in hiring them and training them, and then even providing direct subsidies to make low-wage jobs better paid.
Well, so let me ask you one question here. You know, I think what I'm hearing, one of your underlying concerns is that it might be a disincentive to work, or a disincentive for a teenager to take the kind of risks, 18 to 21 year old, the kind of risks that we want for them to become fully incorporated members of our society here. However, for just to clarify, I don't think any of the baby bonds proposals that we've been discussing with Professor Hamilton, for example, would just like hand anyone a pot of money. There would be some restrictions on how it could be used for buying a home, for education, for starting up a business, as Wendy said her mother had wanted to do. But in addition to that, I've been thinking about this for a while, Mr. Cass. You know, you talked about there might be some families out there who have trust funds. I mean, UTMAs are not uncommon, and I haven't yet heard, maybe they don't, some people think it's not a good idea, but any family who can does, like, they might actually start a UTMA, and no one tells that 18 or 21-year-old, well, you shouldn't have that money, right? I mean, like, these mechanisms exist, or if you don't even want to talk about that, let's talk about 529s. right? So that's money that's going to be used for that child when they turn 18 and go to college that their family was able to save. I mean, so what is the functional difference between those things, which are said to be okay, and no one's saying we shouldn't eliminate UTMAs? What's the functional difference between that and a baby bond?
Well, I think there are two questions here. One is, how exactly would this baby bond function? If we're saying it's going to be constrained and you can only use it for those purposes you described, that I'd be interested to learn more about how that proposal works. The reality is that for low-income households where the students do go on to college, they, of course, receive dramatic financial assistance, and I assume we would essentially just be swapping that out for this other money, which doesn't seem like much of a gain. Nor do I think it's the case that most 18-year-olds are buying houses or starting businesses. In the story that Wendy told, again, it was a fantastic story, but my understanding was her mother wanted to start the business in the brownstone, which was when her mother was in her 50s. I think we should be looking for policies that support young people in building successful lives, but the stories that we're telling today don't connect very well to the baby bond concept. The UTMA example I just want to touch on quickly is really interesting. UTMAs, of course, are trust funds, and the two things I think are really important to notice about this. One is that parents worry very much if they are setting up about a UTMA about how to set something up that does not simply give a kid a bunch of unconstrained cash early in their life. And secondly, when they don't do that, we have a term for that. We call that a trust fund baby. And I'm certainly not denying those exist, but I think the general judgment of our society is that that's not a great thing. And that if you asked most people, is that the right model for parenting? Is that how we want our society to operate? The answer is no. And so if that's our view as parents, then I certainly don't think we should have Uncle Sam showing up and saying, well, we don't care what you think. Me, Uncle Sam, you know, your crazy Uncle Sam just set this up and told your kid all about the money that they're going to get, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Hmm. Well, Oren Kass and Professor Hamilton, hang on here for just a second, because I'm going to squeeze one more voice in here, and it's hard to say that I'm going to squeeze this person in here, but I'm going to try, because Senator Cory Booker is joining us now from Washington. He's a Democratic senator from New Jersey, former presidential candidate, and sponsor of the American Opportunity Accounts Act, which calls for a baby bond. Senator Booker, thank you so much for joining us and for your patience as well.
No, it's so good to be on. Thank you for having me, Magna.
So we've just got a couple of, like, a short time, and I apologize in advance, but there's two specific questions about a reality check that I want to get from you. First of all, just respond to what Oren is saying, that he's still communicating some of those fundamental concerns about the idea of baby bonds and the disincentives that they might bring to a new generation of young people in this country. Just your response.
I so appreciate the substantive conversation you all are having, and appreciate the goodwill of all the guests. And for me, it's just very clear. We use about $630 billion through our tax code to accrue wealth, what they call tax expenditures, to the wealthiest Americans already. And we do that through the mortgage interest deduction. We do that through all kind of breaks for people with money to incentivize them to do. And it's overwhelmingly used by the wealthiest of Americans. And we don't sort of infantilize them by saying they're not responsible enough to make decisions for themselves about what they do with those tax benefits. And so this is sort of the same thing. And along the lines of the Earned Income Tax Credit or the Child Tax Credit, is getting money and wealth, helping people to build wealth for them to begin life in a capitalist system. And they can't just use the money willy-nilly. There are constraints on the resources, on what they can use it for, to continue their education, to get job training, to buy a home, and more. And that's why this bill is supported by everybody, from the home builders to people who are fighting for educational equity. And then the final thing is, as Columbia University has shown, that for Americans, something that's really tragic, that we are still in a nation which, because of the willful acts of government, everything from redlining to denying Social Security and the GI Bill to African Americans, where blacks have about one-tenth of the wealth that white Americans do. And this is a bill that actually for those young people, creates a level economic playing field in a pretty substantive way. So for those reasons, I think this is one of the big ideas that's catching steam. It's an idea that has come from both sides of the political aisle, this idea that you have a bond at your birth that will mature over age that you can use to help you build and gain wealth in this country where that is so determinative of a person's well-being.
Well, so Senator Booker, it's interesting to hear you say that it's catching steam, this idea, because forgive me, but I don't really see anything short of massive stimulus due to an economic emergency catching steam in this Congress. I mean, especially on the Senate side of things. Has there been a change in the tenor of conversation around the idea of baby bonds in the United States Senate and with your colleagues?
Yeah, look, as a guy that came into the Senate and was told that criminal justice reform was virtually impossible, I spent conversation after conversation working with others to get people onto legislation. And that's actually going on now at a pretty good pace. As a senator, I had a conversation with last night saying, this is not typically the kind of bill that I would ever get on. But now given the kind of racial realities in our country that have been exposed to so many, we got another senator to commit to coming on. So this is the hard work of putting a coalition together. But the more this idea is socialized in a larger sense, I think the more that you'll start seeing demands for doing something that can begin to heal the racial wealth gap and to create more economic parity between those who have wealth in this country and the incredible amounts of our families, about a third of Americans who have no or negative wealth. And that's unconscionable. We have to address that.
And Senator, if I may, the senator who came on board was from the other side of the aisle?
Well, again, I've learned in the Senate that you don't discuss that because I don't want to attract attention to folks, but definitely having conversations on both sides of the aisle, and I'm really hopeful that if we continue to talk about this bill, the justice of it, the urgency in healing the wealth gap in America overall and the racial wealth gap in particular, that we will continue to gain some steam in getting this done. And knowing that, you know, the coalition that Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden put together included this as one of their policy planks and policy platforms, there's a lot of sign that a bill that when I first introduced it didn't get that much energy or attention is now beginning to get a lot more of that. And it's a lot of hard work. I don't want to overestimate our ability to get this done. But I know that if more Americans who are looking for a big idea to level the economic playing field, to deal with wealth inequalities, to correct for a system that drives tax system that drives so much of our wealth and our tax dollars through tax expenditures to the wealthiest, that this is actually something that can actually help level the playing field.
Well, Senator Cory Booker with us from Washington. Senator Booker, thank you so much.
Oh, I'm so grateful. Thank you for having a show that focuses on this.
So, Professor Hamilton, you've been very patient here. We've just got a couple of seconds left. We keep picking topics that we can talk about for several hours, but you know, I'll do my best with the time remaining. Do you think you're talking about dwelling in the world of ideas, but you just heard the world of politics from Senator Booker there? Do you think things are actually changing in terms of the political feasibility of this idea?
I certainly think things are changing. There's a movement growing. So to me, there's no question about that. But in the remaining time, there was a plethora of things that Orrin mentioned that I would love to respond to, and I doubt I'll be able to get to all of them. I know he focused.
Well, because we only have about 10 seconds.
Oh, my goodness. So. That's terrible. So Orrin put out a great deal of disinformation by putting numbers like 50,000. The average account would be $25,000. The concept of income versus wealth. Wealth actually does generate income, and the program is targeted at wealth, not income. So he created this false dichotomy of this program versus another program. We don't have to suffer that trade-off. Yeah. We need it all if we want an egalitarian society. And then the last point is his...
Well, I'm going to have to actually cut you off there, Professor. I'm so sorry about that. But what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if we can do an online follow-up to really get a handle on this. So Professor Hamilton and Orrin Cass, thank you so very much for joining us. This is On Point.